In the next hour, we will cover topics and news related to visual digital arts in all its forms. Welcome to Digital Sites. We air every first Thursday of every month here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Stay tuned.
I am Christina, this is Sean, and we will be presenting today our talk entitled Curating Access, a Vital Cultural Aesthetic. And for this talk, we are going to be starting by building a collective conscience. So this is going to be defining some words that we'll be using throughout the presentation, so we're all on the same page moving forward. This will also lead a little bit into what we believe in our politics of our work at Tangled. And next, we'll go into an overview of the disability aesthetic in disability arts in the world history, as well as in Canada's history. I will then be talking a little bit about our gallery programming and our gallery in Toronto. Then I will be discussing kind of disability aesthetics-led accessible outreach and what we can learn from disability arts into community building. Then some resources and quick wins for how we make our work more accessible.
Hey folks, I'm Sean, I'm the Director of Programming at Tangled Art and Disability. I'm just going to give a quick audio description of myself. I'm short, East Asian, visibly disabled, and I'm wearing a kind of like a white dress sweater with a red line that sort of runs up and down the entire thing. It's a single red line, and it's very neat. Feel free to come up and touch it after. And I just want to make sure before we begin that, this space is okay for everyone, that, feel free to kind of get up. Washrooms are just down the corner over there. And feel free to make noise, to get up and to do whatever you need, because this is a very relaxed space. And the way that I think we, Christina and I, do our presentations, it's always really relaxed. Feel free to, just be yourselves in this space. So I'm going to start by giving a description of the image that's currently on the screen above me, which in big white letters on kind of a black navy blue background says the word VIP. And there's an artist, their name is Ebony Rose, in the center, and they're sort of clutching their hair, and they've got this like really intricate headpiece on that resembles branches or maybe like deer antlers, and they're sort of taking this moment to pause in kind of a model-esque pose. And I wanted to start off with this image because the word VIP is done really beautifully, I think, here. Ebony Rose is someone who is from the blind and low vision community, or as Ebony might say, they are a VIP, a visually impaired person. And I think it was important that we start with this image because I wanted to center how we think about disability and how we think about disabled folks, especially BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color from within the community. And by taking on a disability justice politic in what we're talking about, I think we can learn about how it is that when we're curating disability arts, we can put forward these really incredible concepts of curating access as something that is generative and something that is really a way to invigorate our art sector as a whole. This piece here was from a recent conference that we did called Cribbing the Arts. It was the second iteration of this conference, and I think it was really powerful in that it wasn't the first, right? It wasn't just us trying to start from the beginning, but rather we approached disability with nuance, and we were able to bring about really wonderful conversations from folks from throughout the nation and folks from internationally as well. So the reason that I wanted to start with that image was because I think it's important that when we think about what ableism is, how it's sort of seeped into our system, that we include a disability politic that centers BIPOC folks. And I'm going to give a couple of definitions, just so that when we're talking here, we all sort of have an understanding of the different words that have either been reclaimed or have been generated by from within community. The first one is a definition of ableism. It's a working definition that I've gotten that you know I've been just privileged enough to glean from leaders like Talia T.L. Lewis and Dustin P. Gibson. And it's a definition of ableism that folks might not be as familiar with. So I'm just going to read out what's on the screen. And it says that ableism is a system that places value on people's bodies and minds based on societally constructed ideas of normalcy, intelligence, excellence, and productivity. These constructed ideas are deeply rooted in anti-blackness, eugenics, colonialism, and capitalism. This form of systemic oppression leads to people in society determining who is valuable and worthy based on a person's appearance and or their ability to satisfactorily reproduce, excel, and behave. You do not have to be disabled to experience ableism. And I think this is really important because it helps us to locate disability within all the proximities of oppression. It allows us to think about how as Mia Mingus, who's a disability scholar and who I will talk about later, would say, Mia Mingus kind of talks about how ableism is this idea of how we move in the world to a mythical ideal of normalcy. That is the body that is typically male, that is typically white, that is typically able-bodied, that's typically heteronormative. And all these ways in which we navigate the world against this false ideal of normalcy brings us back to these definitions of ableism. And so these ideas of neoliberal politics, of what we are worth, what we produce, that's deeply ingrained in how ableism dictates how we have to move in society. And so ableism here isn't just about proximity necessarily to disability, but rather it allows us to invigorate our understandings of the constructs of the world, constructs of society, and what is valued, what is understood as kind of quote-unquote normal. And this definition of ableism, I think, helps us to recognize the many moving complications that intersect within ableism and in within this framework of disability. We move on to defining the word "crip," which is one of my favorite words. It's a reclaimed word, and disability scholar Kelly Fritsch uses it as a verb. And for those who are familiar with crip culture, probably recognize this word. And the way that we use it is as a verb to open with desire for the different ways that disability disrupts. And this disruption is really what we embrace within disability arts and culture and within the process of curatorial kind of frameworks of disability arts. Defining accessibility, and Mia Mingus, who will kind of come up throughout this this talk, really, Mia Mingus gives, I think, a really great definition that accessibility is concrete resistance to the isolation of disabled people. And in this way, I think Mia Mingus is pointing out that, this idea of creating community from disability is really still radical. Historically, disabled folks, whether from MAD, deaf, disability communities, were really isolated as something that was the phenomenon solely in the body, solely in the individual. And in this medical model, this idea of forming community through disability was something that was not encouraged. The solution to disability really was to fix the person rather than you know, the factors that are disabling. And so Mia Mingus is kind of noting here that accessibility is this way that we can resist and gesture to the different models of community building that might be located when we open to that disruption of disability. And finally, disability justice, which I think is the underpinning framework to how we approach disability arts here in Tangled. And Mia Mingus again gives a beautiful definition of disability justice, so I'm just going to go roll with that. Mia Mingus says that it's disability justice is a multi-issue political understanding of disability and ableism, moving away from a rights-based equality model and beyond just access to a framework that centers justice and wholeness for all disabled people and communities. And disability justice really does center queer and trans BIPOC folks, and was one that was created by and for communities who have otherwise been isolated from what was typically seen as the disability rights model that that saw disability as something in a silo, as something unfettered by the different influences of of oppression and the different ways that you know, these communities intersect. So now I'm getting into the artistic side of things, now that we kind of have a bit of a basis. And I'm going to start with this idea of a disability aesthetic. And this was really, you know, this is something that's been employed throughout history. And in here I have a definition by Tobin Siebers, who smartly articulates that disability aesthetics seeks to emphasize the presence of different bodies and minds in the tradition of aesthetic representation. So that tradition that's most precisely concerned with the appearance of the beautiful. And what I mean here, and what I will maybe, what maybe helps click for the, for this concept, is in the next photo, I have a, in the next slide, I have a photo of the Venus de Milo. And the Venus, for folks who are unfamiliar, this photo is a marble bust of Venus, who is like a Roman a goddess of some sort, and the statue that is the iconic Venus de Milo is one that's depicted without arms. And, you know, scholars from art history have long debated whether or not the Venus, if the Venus de Milo had arms, would be this moment of iconography. And I think what Tobin Siebers smartly does is recognize that the Venus de Milo's aesthetic, the disability aesthetic that's employed here, an aesthetic of beauty through imperfection, is one that's been recognized time immemorial. We can think of things like, you know, the Leaning Tower of Pisa. You know, imperfection here is what is a resource almost for an art history to employ. And yet, a disability aesthetic doesn't necessarily center disabled artists, disabled folks. And so that, I think, is where we get into disability art. And in this next slide, I have, you know, what is disability arts on? And I want to give us all a definition that I love of disability arts by Yinka Shonabare, who is a Turner Prize nominated blue chip artist, incredible artist from the UK. And he parallels the emergence of disability arts to feminist arts, to black arts, to queer arts. And he notes that disability arts is the last avant-garde movement, sort of situating the way that the emergence of those have really helped to upheave and rethink what it is that the arts sector can do in other ways that have stagnated. And so I really love to situate our disability arts canon within both the sort of larger, you know, art history, but also as something that's outside, something that is reinvigorating our sector with things that are things like accessible curatorial practices, with things like, you know, artists who are really taking hold in ways that are new, ways that are exciting. And in this photo, I have, in this slide, I have a photo of Allison Lapper pregnant by the artist Mark Quinn. And this is a very controversial piece of art because Mark Quinn is not a disabled artist. And yet, Allison Lapper is a disabled artist, an activist from the UK, and chose to be a subject for Mark to create. And in this piece, you know, it's a hyper-visible marble bust that recalls some of the, like, historical, you know, busts that were reserved for folks of, you know, quote-unquote importance throughout history. And I think Alison Lapper is reclaiming this through the use of, you know, this platform that is Mark Quinn and that is the Trafalgar Square, you know, site-specific work over here. And so that's the question. Is this disability arts? And I don't think there is one simple answer for whether or not this is disability arts, but I think what it recognizes is that there are so many complicated nuances to how we can approach disability arts. And that's where the place of curation, I think, really helps us to understand how folks from within community can use curatorial practice as a way to think about what is disability arts. And the reason that we need disability arts is because, as Catherine Frazee would say, it's a way to come to pride. And on here, there's a quote from Catherine Frazee, who's a disability scholar and just an incredible disability activist. And what she says is that before we can begin to push back against injustice and dignity and indignity, before we can rise up from the swirl of rage and despair, before we can speak back to a script that casts us as tragic victims and bitter villains, we must have pride. Good art is both the product and the sustenance of human imagination, and so art brings us together in ways that invoke moral imagination, summoning us to justice, dignity, and all the great qualities of human progress. It is perhaps only through art and its activism, activation of imagination, that we can both conceive of and be moved resolutely towards visions of equality and justice. That is how we come to pride together. I think the word pride here really captures a wonderful moment of how our different movements can come together. There are so many parallels between disability justice and queer movements. And one thing that I think is noted here is this idea that these ideas about communities not being as being isolated, as being solely located in the body, are ones that are socially constructed. That we can come together through these social movements and through these moments of finding each other in community. And so we need pride in order to really recognize who we are as a community. And pride is done through things like art. And before I move on, there's a really wonderful photo here from Tangled Art Gallery in 2019, when we had an exhibition called Through a Tired Eye. And Through a Tired Eye is an exhibition by an artist named Bruce Horak, who's from the blind and low vision community. And Bruce kept getting asked, "How do you see?" And that's a question I think that is not new to disabled folks. You know, the "How do you blank?" But Bruce, what was interesting was that Bruce took this moment and used it as a teachable moment to bring in a series in which he invited folks both from within and outside of the disability community to contribute to this large 1,000-person series in which folks would sit down with Bruce and Bruce would draw the way he saw. And it's interesting, as he became more embroiled in aspects of disability justice, in aspects of access, he began to draw not what he thought folks look like, but really what he saw, all the moments of, you know, auras and flickers and the different colors that kind of blur together. He really began to do that. And so this charts a really interesting evolution of not only the different people that were involved with this project, but actually the evolution of Bruce's politics within disability. And I thought this was a really great moment of demonstrating how, as you come to Pride to discover your own aesthetic, as the change in your own like artistic practice can also become invigorated through pride and through these aspects of a disability or a crip aesthetic, as you would. And so coming to pride means that we can really begin to desire disability differently. And this is a quote from Kelly Fritsch and Anne McGuire in a forthcoming issue around disability that they have. And what they say is that disability is here and it's in our futures. It's not something we have, but something we participate in. And in this way, we vitally need disability arts and culture and disability pride as much as we need access, healthcare, housing, and employment. For these are the means by which we can live with disability. These are, in other words, the specific practices, sensibilities, and discourses that imbue disability not only with possibility, but with transformative meaning, value, and desirability. And I think this is so important because, you know, disabled artists are agents of world building and world dismantling through our practices, through the creative ways that we can navigate our society, through the creative ways that we can participate in the arts. And so in order to really think about where we are as a society, we have to desire this disability with that embraces the difference, that embraces the disruption. Because when we're curators curating disability arts, we can't just neatly fold in artists that might be able to participate in a normative framework. But rather, we have to recognize that we're trying to embrace this disruption and recognize the different ways that we can actually work together. And I think desiring disability differently allows us to think about the different ways that disability can really be generative and can really be something that allows us to, you know, recognize the world in a different capacity and recognize the ableism that affects all of us. And so now I'm really going to finally get into curation, and I'll talk a bit about this, but I'm happy to take more questions. And there are a couple of exhibitions from this year that I really wanted to highlight. At Tangled Art Gallery, we launched in 2016, and what was really interesting is that we began as a platform for artists. I think there's always been a bit of a stickiness in thinking about curatorial excellence, if you will, and its relationship to disability arts because of historic curators like Jean Dubuffet, who, you know, would come into institutions and steal disabled artists' works and put them up and bar them from participating in their own exhibitions, in receiving payment for their art, in really even participating as artists. And this was because there was this desire for an outsider artist and for outsider art in which the value, quote unquote, of the work wasn't recognized until a curator came in with their critical eye and you know, picked up this work and gave an assigned value to it. And so disability arts, I think, has always had a bit of resistance to this idea that a curator should come in and tell us what is our art. But as the years have gone on and Tangled has learned and established new accessible curatorial practices and has really begun to experience a flourishing of disability arts, we've recognized that the need is there and the artists are there, but the spaces that can curate this art is really lacking. And so there's a bit of a narrative that I'll touch on as we go on. But here in this exhibition called Body Farm by Valentine Brown, Valentine was an artist who is both trans and autistic and talks about how his work is really trauma-informed. And his work here was so incredibly thoughtful. The way that he created works was really both with access in mind. And what's on this image here is one of a multitude of two-dimensional paintings and 2D drawings, and they're all sort of, you know, these organic creatures and monsters, tentacles, body parts that loosely reference an experience of, the monster. And what Valentin did was, instead of creating an audio description for each piece, because Tangled creates audio descriptions for all of our exhibitions, Valentin recognized that creating an audio description of over 100 pieces and 1,000 sculptures really wouldn't serve its purpose. And instead, he wove together a narrative of his experience, this exhibition marking the beginning of a year-long period of medical transition for him. And he created a narrative that was called his quote-unquote captain's logs. And through these captain's logs, he painted a picture of what the works were meant to embody. And he created touchable pieces, sculptures, and soft pieces filled with, you know, all sorts of complex parts that created this idea of the complexity of the body farm, if you would. And so I thought this was a really wonderful way that we can make space for artists to think about accessible curation without being too didactic. This was an artist who was already interested in creating the works and only needed some guidance around how to best, curate their work and bring it into a space. Aslan Thomas was part of an exhibition called Flourishing, a series called Flourishing. And I think one of our artists from Flourishing is actually here. Salima, are you still here?
Yep.
All right, great. Welcome. Aslan over here really wanted to play off of this idea of audio description. And I think what was really neat about Aslan's piece was that Aslan wanted to create an invitation to softness. So there's a photo here of like a locker room in which there's a single projection on the screen, and in the projection is this window. And it's a very humble piece that's just a window blowing slightly in the breeze. And Aslan wanted to think about the different ways that we value production. And so she created this, and then she thought, well, how do I want to create an audio description for this piece? And what she did was she invited three other disabled artists and poets to come offer an audio description, but not just any audio description, one that matched the length of each shot of the windows. And then she cycled them. So there would be the video playing and then just audio description. And she wanted to think about the poetics of audio description in this way. And what was interesting was how many folks would come in and tell us the piece is not working. This is a piece that they thought didn't have the video, and so it was broken. And it was a nice moment of intervention for us to allow folks to rethink what is, you know, quote unquote visual arts. And Aslan was drawing off of the knowledge and the expertise of other artists to create these audio descriptions and really generating crypt community, I think, through this piece. And finally, this is an exhibition that I curated with Emily Cook, another disabled artist, at the Critical Distance Center for Curators. And the piece is the exhibition is called Access is Love and Love is Complicated. So it plays off of this idea of Access is Love, which is really something that was created by Alice Wong and Sandy Ho and Mia Mingus, centering this idea of access being just another word for love. But then if we wanted to recognize access as love, then we're also taking a pop cultural understanding that love is complicated. Because we've been told that our disability is not something to create community through, that when we're, you know, radically generating community through access and through being able to bring others into a space together, there will be frictions. And I think that friction is a beautiful one that we can embrace and use to invigorate our artistic sector. So in this exhibition, we had a number of different accessible kind of pieces that, you know, did create these ideas of friction. There was an artist named Andy Slater who is a blind artist who creates a lot of sand work. And so he wanted to create a beautiful, poetic, audio descriptive piece. So a really nice designed book that went with his audio piece. And then he recognized that by making the aesthetic of this piece so integral to the sound work, he suddenly had, you know, made the piece inaccessible to his own community through this book. And so then he thought, okay, I'm going to create a Braille version of this book and a simplified audio description of what the book is. And then he thought, you know, do I need ASL for this now? And, you know, there's that cycle of where, if access becomes part of the aesthetic, then where does it stop, right? Where, when does it stop serving the audience? And when does it just become sort of a think piece on access? Yeah. And so it was a really wonderful moment of aha. And, you know, we brought Andy together. We brought artists from neurodivergent communities and with learning disabilities that, with cognitive disabilities that I think haven't been necessarily centered within the disability arts movement, because they are oftentimes working with a collaborator. And so the question of authorship and you know, independence and authorship becomes something that is thrown into question and complicates our understanding of disability arts. So we really wanted to bring artists with different cognitive disabilities in. Vanessa Dion Fletcher, who's an Indigenous artist, noted that, you know, this idea of disability is really a colonial construct, that in a lot of Indigenous societies, disabled folks have their place, have their, you know, different, you know, moments in the community. They're knowledge keepers, they're storytellers. And so disability arts may not fit within an Indigenous lexicon necessarily. And we wanted to bring Vanessa in to complicate these ideas of how we identify proudly with disability while still recognizing the different ways that disability is problematic, is a colonial construct, can be from things like environmental racism, and can skew, you know, mental health can skew more heavily in racialized communities. And so these complicated ways that we wanted to think about access and disability community were brought into this exhibition. And so I'll be happy to talk more about it, but I'm gonna bring it over to Christina next.
Amazing. Well, thank you, Sean. With such a brilliant director of programming and curator of disability arts in my boss, Sean Lee, as my job at Tangled in Communications, it really is to match what he does in the gallery space and a curator space, that I'm reaching out to audiences that will be interested, invested in the art that we're doing, while also providing a safe space for our community and our audiences to have conversations both about our work, but also not about our work, that we can have a reciprocal relationship with, that we are constantly pushing forth the notion of what is accessible, what is disability art, not only from the top-down curator organization to community, but also a bottom-up from the community and listening to us. So on the screen here, I have a photograph of all of the Tangled staff, blurry in the background, with one of our artists that we work with currently, Peter Owusu Onsa. And this is kind of one of our favorite photos that I just like to add. In Peter being a Black deaf artist in Toronto and constantly needing to navigate the world. Is this better? Okay. And so for us, like, having a gallery like Tangled to be a place in which Peter can showcase his work, be supported, is really a value to us and really serves the community with aligning the curatorial direction that we have. A lot of also what we do, what I do in my work, kind of breaks down into what is outreach, what is community building, and that can kind of be broken down into the language of my external facing community communication, the aesthetics of it, the design of it, and then just the actual mechanism, how do we reach new people. So for my job, I work a lot with all of our artists that Sean has so brilliantly curated to find ways to promote their shows, and then curating a voice that our public and our community will be comfortable with and that will be inviting to them coming in. And so I do this, again, through language. And so what is accessible language? And that refers back to that definition that Sean offered, Mia Lingus's definition of accessibility being the concrete resistance of the discrimination of disabled folks. So what does that mean when it's language? So that can be plain language, which is prioritizing a logical, active, and short, common way of communicating our highest needs. So oftentimes in arts and curatorial spaces, we want to add all the artistic jargon. We want to flex how well we did at art school. But that language can be very discriminatory to a lot of various different folks. For many years, disabled bodies have been excluded from conversations about art and culture through semantics alone. And so as cultural creators, as curators, using language as an indicator that we are accessible to a community, whether they are English as a second language or French as a second language, whether they are ASL or LSQ users, or in some have a cognitive disability. And like taking that impetus on ourselves as curators and creators to refine our language, we are taking that one step forward that our new audiences are welcome and safe and invited and desired into our spaces. It's also making sure that we're not using ableist tropes. So ableism lives in our society in behavioral ideas, as well as linguistic ideas, as well as attitudinal behaviors. And so just on the screen right now, I have a few examples of what have been really community-led language changes that are really breaking down, again, that definition of a resistance under discrimination. So non-ableist language being driven by disabled bodies, by disabled minds, on a community identification. So some of these are saying capital D, deaf and hard of hearing, as opposed to hearing impaired. In a lot of deaf communities, they see it as a community-driven and not a removal of hearing. As well as wheelchair user, not wheelchair bound. The word bound has so many negative connotations, whereas there is actually no negativity of being a wheelchair user. And then we had the blind and low vision and not visually impaired. Sean mentioned Anthony's desire to call themselves a visually impaired person, which is why there's an asterisk there. Because in that community, identifying as the self, as a visually impaired person, is a self-identification. However, for sighted folks, that isn't our turn to use. And there's still a lot of conversation within the community of whether or not that is word like CRIP that can be used by non-members of the community. And then disabled or disability identified and not handicapped. Again, handicapped comes back to this negative connotation that we really want to move forward and move into that idea of desiring disability. And then has, as opposed to things like victim of or suffers from, again, going back to language as a way of indicating that there is this concrete resistance to language as a way that has been discriminatory to disabled bodies. And then also on the screen, I just had non-ableist language is ever-evolving and community-led. And if you aren't sure what words to use or not use, to ensure that you ask members of that said community. So often people are willing to tell you what they feel most comfortable with. And I think it's always great to take that one step forward. If you're talking about a community that you're not involved in, that's also that one step as culture workers, as cultural creators, of building a more accessible future. And then we have accessible design. So we've gone through what we are saying to describe this brilliant curatorial programming we have. How are we visually displaying that? So on the screen, I have an icon that says size matters, and it's typographic element. And this just kind of is math, which all artists love, and how to make sure that our words on a piece of paper are large enough, or our words on a piece on a wall mount are large enough. So some math on here and just like the distance of your viewer divided by 2.5 is the height in inches that your letters should be if you want folks to read them. Folks will be able to have this document after presentation, but this is just those small things that we can do to start dismantling ableism. So if we want to invite folks from the blind and low vision community into our spaces, doing things like having large enough text allows them to feel desired, to feel like they are wanted in a space. And also ways that we can just use graphic design as a tool for pushing accessible visual aesthetics. And so on the screen right now, I have a screenshot of a brochure that we designed at Tangled for our season exhibition, Flourishing. And this was a big conversation in the office of how we could use something like plain language to push forth a disability aesthetic and what that can be as a desired vital cultural aesthetic. And so we played with what can plain language offer. So as opposed to using some vague idea of what our season was, what our series was, we had in white text on a dark green background, this is the brochure for Flourishing. So it was a very intentional use of plain language for having folks to know what they were looking at. And then that was broken up, and on the bottom half in black lettering and pink lettering, we had an exhibition series by Tangled Art Gallery. So using that visual indication that there are two separate things that we want you to know and ensuring that that you know exactly what it is. We also decided to include our logo as a graphic element on the front of the book. Because we still had Tangled Art Gallery on the front, folks who aren't familiar with our organization would just see it as a aesthetically pleasing, tangled line. But folks who are familiar with us would immediately have a visual indication of whose season brochure this was. And this has been really fun for us because it was one of our most highly received brochures, and there was a lot of conversations about why we made those choices. And that's kind of what we aim to do at Tangled, is always pushing for what can access give to our community. So often it's seen as like an add-on and like, oh, I have to make something accessible. But I think that having this example of what we used with plain language and graphic design really gave to our community and gave also a lot of opportunities for folks interested in accessible graphic design at kind of touch point to work from. And then we're all here because we're in the arts. Visual art is not always accessible. So on the screen, I have a piece of Peter Owusu Onsa's work. He was a community member that was photographed a few slides back. And when we had his show, or his group's show, we had a lot of conversations about how we were going to do audio description for his work. As a deaf artist, he uses colors to really evoke emotions. So what language were we going to use to describe this image for blind and low vision folks? And so we really had to have this conversation of what it would offer. And I will offer what we came up with, which was a large square image made up of multiple mini squares that make a pixelated look to this piece. The colors range half of them around light grays and dark grays, and half of them in bright reds, pinks, and yellows. When you interact with this piece in real life, as you walk towards it and away from it, the contrast of the colors give a movement of a feel. When Peter Owusu Onsa was making this piece, he saw it as sun hitting an iceberg. And he saw it as the world, and he saw it as a place of creating emotions for folks to feel. And so that was the audio description that we offered our community. And I always choose this piece in this section of the presentation because this was the most commented on piece in that actual show, as everyone seemed to have an emotional reaction to it when they engaged with it, or if they engaged with the audio description. And it was also a piece that we had a lot of conversations in the gallery. While everyone that works in our gallery is a sighted individual, we all see things differently and we all interpret things differently. And it came back to this conversation of what are we actually telling our audience that what they are looking at and what the piece is, when the art in general is supposed to evoke an emotion. And so how does that build community? We can talk a lot about spaces in community building and digital spaces in community building. And so both of those can be outreach by untargeted outreach and targeted outreach. So untargeted outreach is outreach that reaches an existing community. They already engage with your organizations and your events, and they aren't individuals who necessarily need to be informed on upcoming events, but they want updates on access policies and event locations as possible. And so this is good to keep in mind, as it is very different from targeted outreach. So this is potentially reaching communities that are not engaging with your organization. They need to be educated on what your organization does as well as upcoming events, and they need to be informed on access policies, event locations, to be comfortable to attend an event for the first time. Again, by adding this information, we are making spaces accessible, we are breaking down those barriers of discrimination, like giving information, and there may need to be some level of incentivization or specific reasons to get involved. And so some examples of untargeted outreach would be our website. People already know our URL, they know our newsletter, they've already asked to be involved, invites that we send folks, as well as the social media. And then our targeted outreach would be like targeted paid for advertising, which we know that we're going to be reaching a specific community, as well as specific event postings, oftentimes with partner organizations. And then we also have all of the Nassen social media. And I put these on this slide together to show that at the end of the day, via the power of the internet, almost all of our untargeted outreach and targeted outreach intersect. And so by knowing that, it's important that when we are creating outreach to include all of those access features, to give incentives for folks to get involved, to give information about your organization. So we are inviting people at all times and using our Facebook page, our Twitter page, our website as those sites of desiring new audiences, by informing them of our access components, informing them of our event locations. And then how do we do that on social media? In our very first definition of what is ableism, we talked about it being, being a capitalist construct. And unfortunately, social media is run by the large conglomerates in capitalism. And what we're seeing today is there is this concrete resistance of ableism on social media, and a lot of the large Facebook, Twitter, Instagram are working to make their spaces more accessible, which is a brilliant thing to do. But it's also important for us as cultural workers, cultural creators, to know the best practices. So I'm going to walk through a little bit of those best practices. So Instagram in early 2019 finally rolled out the ability to add image description. And this was a really brilliant thing to have, as Facebook has had them for quite a lot longer, but Instagram took quite a long time to roll it out. And so there are ways to add them. It's very difficult to find, which is very infuriating. But when you go to post a picture at the very, very bottom of the section in small, small lettering that is very difficult to read, it says advanced setting. And only there can you add an alt text. And then you can go back into, and you can go and it brings up the window that allows you to add all this alt text. And once you embed that alt text and you look at your phone, if you are a sighted individual, it looks exactly like any other Instagram post. However, for blind and low vision audiences, as well as folks who engage with audio as opposed to visual content, their phone will read out your description and then your caption. So you're prioritizing both of your sighted and non-sighted audiences, as well as those who may be doing multiple other tasks while also scrolling in through Instagram, like we all do. Twitter, also equally as infuriating, in that you have to go into your advanced settings and turn on a component to allow you to write alt text. It doesn't automatically come on any Twitter account. Why that is, I do not know. But once you add a photo onto your Twitter, it has a little icon on the bottom right-hand side that will say add description. And when you click on this, again, pop out the window. The one thing to keep in mind for Twitter is image descriptions have to be a maximum of 420 characters. So it limits how much information you are allowed to give your audience. But much like Instagram, once you post it, for sighted viewers, it looks the exact same as a Twitter post without an Instagram caption. I also will note that Twitter, which uses hashtags the most, when you are tweeting, it's really important to use title character cases when doing hashtags. If you have all lowercase or all uppercase letters, screen reader technology will just read that out letter by letter by letter, rendering it completely inaccessible. However, Twitter has back-end design that if you have a capital letter and the first letter of each word in your hashtag, it will read it out hashtag entangled affair, which is the example on the screen. And lastly, Facebook, very, very similar to the other institution. You add an image and then it has settings. The one issue with Facebook at this current moment in time is they are currently rolling out AI to write descriptions for their images. While I applaud this attempt, they are factually incorrect almost 100% of the time. So with Facebook, it's almost the most imperative that we write these descriptions ourselves and we override what the Facebook AI is trying to do. Not only does this better serve our audience, but it also better serves Facebook because then they are getting data of what is a good description, which will continue to serve their AI. And then here I had a photo of our Cripping the Art symposium that Sean mentioned earlier. On the screen are five different speakers sitting in chairs with microphones, and we see one of our interpreters on stage. In the foreground of the photo, there's a back of the audience's head. And then on the screen, it says top three disability art criticism and pet peeves. And I put this on because Cripping the Arts was one of our larger undertakings as an organization, being that it was three full days of programming, two nights of performance, and we are welcoming about 150 people into our space at any one given time. And given that we are an access-centered organization, it was imperative that we made all of the events that we were providing to our community fully accessible. And so a few of the things that we did to make our event fully accessible is hosting it in barrier-free spaces that are close to public transportation. Just doing this right away enforces a notion that folks who rely on public transportation or use any sort of mobility device are desired and wanted. We also offer free and community-reduced tickets for community members. For our events at Tangle, they're always free. And when we do cost-reduced tickets for community members, we ensure that those are ingrained as a honesty is the best policy member on any ticketing website. And by just having it as an honesty is the best policy part of the website, it doesn't require folks to give any sort of vulnerable information about their income, about their safety. There is just an understanding that folks who need reduced tickets can access them. Hiring ASL interpreters when possible, as well as care attendants when possible. Live captioning when possible for videos. And when providing food, ensuring that there's allergy-respectful food. And then lastly, communicating any access components to your community as well. And if if not more importantly, communicate any barriers to access. So oftentimes when we are creating accessible events, access forward, and then we want to screen from the rooftops what we've done to make an event accessible. The problem is we often don't want to talk about what we are unable to provide. But by ensuring that we communicate any potential barriers to access, it becomes a radical act of respect to our community, in that we have envisioned bodies that aren't ours, minds that aren't ours, entering spaces. And by communicating any barriers to access, it allows folks to have agency over decision-making processes of whether or not they want to enter that space safely. As opposed to saying, hey, we will have ASL interpreters, and then assuming that there will also be a barrier free venue. And then somebody in a wheelchair arrives, assuming that it's accessible, and it's not. And so as cultural creators, it's important that we are always willing to listen to our community, but also ensure that we localize if at any time they aren't able to attend our events, with the understanding that one day they will.
That's it for today. Make sure to tune in next month. Digital Sites airs every first Thursday of every month from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal or online at ckut.ca. For 1 hour, we cover topics and news related to digital visual arts. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is Derek Singer, stay-at-home dad and pre-COVID comedian. I'm sorry, I'm eating a hot turkey sandwich. Again, I made tons for the holidays. I'll probably still be eating turkey till Valentine's Day. But it's time we talk about our resolutions. Please, stay at home and limit your contacts. Let's protect each other. And if anyone has a recipe that calls for 17 pounds of leftover turkey, I really need that. Like, really. Let's keep our spirits up.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Revolution! Revolution! Yeah! Revolution! today, snakes. We hate war. We hate war. They hate peace. So we make war and I make peace. That's a great war we were made for. We were not made to just lay dormant. They stay on top. They pay the cops. They take office. They make laws and then say stop. They say war just makes war. But then take forces when state forces are lame force. And then they say that they're brave warriors and save yours. But they're fake prophets. They make war because they profit. They make rockets on all sides. Then all lines they pop. Watch the masters of war. These fat cats cash in tax free on the backs of the poor masses. Diplomats with a mask of decorum. We warn them never storm in the castle. It's warranted for the horrors they enact. They'll pay for it. We paid more than our fair share. And it ain't fair that we take theirs. They took yours. They made the war. They wage war. Create war. We hate war. We hate war. They hate peace. So we make war and I make peace. That's great war. We were made for it. We were not made to just lay dormant. They invade shores. They raid homes. They rain bombs. And the rain pours. They make war.
Look. We don't make war. We make sure that there's order. We just follow orders. We just fill orders for more ballistics.
And this was the episode of Transgressive Tams, a how-to guide for Black and Arab Imams. The music you've heard today was by Ani Barbara. The visual by Nevada Barbara. The production team is Al Barbara, Eve Parker Finley, and Estelle Davis. Thank you so much again, everyone, for tuning in. Have a great rest of the day.
Santa gets corona. We no want him round ya. Nobody no inna the chimney ya. No present no left out ya. The whole year the pampas is like it's stuck in a coma. We glad it done till 2021. We stepping over. Donald Trump a leave. Biden take it over. What's gonna be the difference when no visa na run bout ya? If them say vaccine fit take before you touch the airport ya. No matter if you're ballad, matter if you're rasta. Bible revelation, what a passa passa. What you gonna tell the pitney them when them get older? Fi overstand the myth and all the lies. Hard work and sacrifice. Just to make them nice when we attract them road ya. Stay in line, stay in tune. Build up your immune. Them what we do, me still a pray for this thing over soon. Mash up the earth, then them say them want leave a moon. No for them in a them bunker, they chase and they safe and secure and up. Nuff the pan the life, only fans, no for them assume. As some a turn them on a bus in a them bathroom. No matter what, stand firm, me just a confirm. Say life is more than one term, we're bigger than the damn germ. Can't tell the ghetto youth them nothing about no jingle bell. After man on no infidel, Babylon I go sink in hell. So every time fall, eat me rice if you think me fell. Hustlers, never give up, no lose the bucket in the well. Nuff I look things for sell, nuff I look things for thief. Scammer them out enough, watch your card, keep receipt. Nuff of them say them a family and friend and sit down drinks and kin them teeth. Say them now go sell you out, one drink of rum them quick for tweet. Yo, a world crisis, all of we a face it. Some a face it harder than some, you can't escape it. Give thanks to Jah, fire get up every day fit. Wonder when they work.